Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. In his new book, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America, South Dakota essayist and religion writer Joseph Bottom explores the notion that today secular liberals have taken the role formerly filled by mainline Protestant churches. The result, he argues, is the rise of politics as a form of spiritual decision. Bottom's been called one of America's best writers on religion. He's written for The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. He's the former literary editor of The Weekly Standard and the former editor-in-chief of the religious journal First Things. He's also the author of The Christmas Plains, a reflection of his childhood memories of Christmas in South Dakota. He returned to South Dakota a few years ago and now lives with his family in Hot Springs. Joseph Bottom, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why do you call this an anxious age?
Well, one of the things I was exploring in the book is what happened when what we all know is true, which is that the mainline Protestant churches have simply collapsed. And they really have collapsed. You know, the average age of a Congregationalist in the UCC is 63. And the Congregationalists were foundational church for America. What happens when they go away? This kind of mainline Protestant experience has always been a stable leg of the American experiment. And what happens when it goes away, when we don't have it anymore, was the question that I set myself when I began the book. And I began to think that just because these people and their children and their grandchildren stopped going to church, it doesn't mean that the spiritual anxieties which those churches used to answer somehow suddenly went away. In fact, they remain. People are anxious about their salvation, although they phrase it now about anxiety about whether or not they're good people. And I began to think that when the churches collapsed, those mainline Protestant churches collapsed, that kind of anxiety got set loose like a strange demon or a strange angel to enter politics. And it occurred to me that we live in what can only be called a spiritual age, when we suppose that our political opponents are not merely mistaken about politics, but are actually evil.
So how did we get to this point where the political world is now the place where so many people in this country are seeking salvation?
Well, as I said, I think it comes from the collapse of a central leg of the American experiment, which is this, you know, what Alexis de Tocqueville called the undivided current of American Protestantism. Now, of course, there are many serious believers left in these churches, and there's a whole wing of Protestantism that always stood outside the mainline churches in the evangelicals. But this kind of central liberal consensus used to be located in the mainline Protestant churches, and it is no longer. And when it escapes that, it doesn't escape the attitudes that defined the mainline Protestant churches for over 100 years, which I describe primarily through the figure of the great preacher Walter Rauschenbusch as the social gospel movement.
So these post-Protestants are essentially heirs to this social gospel movement?
Absolutely. Rauschenbusch's genius, whether he invented the idea or not, his genius was to popularize and make present in everyone's mind the idea that sin is fundamentally a social force, not a personal one. And that to know that you are redeemed, to be redeemed, and then to have the confidence to overcome the anxiety about your redemption, to know that you are redeemed, requires only an attitude of mind in which you reject social evil. You reject the sins of bigotry and militarism and mass opinion and the violence of the mob. And these social sins, as Rauschenbusch described them, if you reject them, then you have a redeemed personality. And that idea of sin is fundamentally a social force, a kind of metaphysical cloud that hangs over society, that hangs over much of human history, and that you need to reject it. That idea became really broadly spread in the mainline Protestant churches through this social gospel movement. One of the things that happens is you no longer need Jesus Christ in these churches. Christ becomes, in the metaphor I use, for the social gospel movement, Christ becomes this ladder by which you climb up to a higher ledge to see the social sins. And once you're there, you don't need the ladder anymore. And in that way, if you don't need the ladder, if you don't need Christ, then why are you going to church? And lo and behold, a kind of attrition began to take place in the mainline Protestant churches until we have their catastrophic collapse. One of the figures I give in the book is that at the high water mark of 1965, just about 50% of Americans attended one allied branch or another of the mainline Protestant churches in America. Today, less than 10% do.
So what happens then with these Christian conceptions of sin and redemption within this post-Protestant world?
Well, once you've got the transition made out of sin being something personal into sin becoming something social, that idea doesn't go away. It just isn't locused in the churches anymore. It drifts up and around into the available space in our society. I mean, this book is very much a sociological examination of America. And one of the places where it's clearly found a home on both the left and the right is in politics, where we have this inability, for instance, to distinguish the people with whom we disagree from absolute evil. So that, it feels right to say to some people, for their politics, it feels right to say that the Republican Congress is the Taliban, or that the governor of Wisconsin is a Nazi. And for another set of people, it feels right to say that President Obama is a communist. We lose any kind of distinctions, because after all, if sin and my knowledge of my own redemption are fundamentally based on my attitude toward the social sins, then those social sins become, the defining thing. This becomes a matter of religion and spirituality rather than a matter of politics, which is to say the right governance of the country.
So is this one of the reasons why we're experiencing such a deadlock in so much of our political institutions, particularly in Washington, D.C.?
It's not just one of the reasons. I think it's the fundamental reason. I could ask you to change your politics if I thought they were political. I could argue with them about them, or argue with you about them. But I can't argue with you about your religion. Right? These positions become locked in. We see a kind of affirmation even in losing a political battle, because at least you fought the good fight. That's a sort of religious, spiritual feeling. And people increasingly take the kind of self-identification, self-knowledge with which they once called themselves Presbyterians or Methodists, they now take with identification with political party.
So then we see this applied to issues, say, like minimum wage, where some will argue that this is a moral issue, while others might say it's an economic issue, and there's no way you could argue or make a persuasive case if you believe this is a moral issue.
Right. It becomes simply a matter of, affirmation of the good instead of acceptance or unacceptance of the true.
So what we're looking at is people are still have that same hunger or desire to find something more, that looking for perhaps that purpose that the churches once filled that helped us find those answers.
Right, but the churches did something more for America than simply these mainline Protestant churches. They did something more than merely fulfill this universal human hunger to feel that there's more to the world than just physical experience, to feel that there's something supernatural in the world. The mainline Protestant churches fulfilled that hunger, or fed that, it fed the food necessary because of that hunger. But they also did something else. They constrained it. They corralled and tamed it. This is a very dangerous human emotion. And that needs theological definition, that needs some kind of social control. When it breaks free from the churches, it becomes a wild thing. And I see it in our politics everywhere. The anger and the hatred and the distaste for the other on both the left and the right. And, you know, the churches used to contain that. Now, suppose you had the attitude of one of those old, you know, Episcopalians of the 19th century, where even though they were only about 2% of the population, 3%, they imagined that somehow they were the center of America. They were, you know, the mainstream. If you have that attitude, but you no longer go to church, you no longer even really conceive of yourself in churchly terms, that attitude becomes an attitude of wanting to or imagining that you're at the center of things, that those who disagree with you are somehow evil. And that becomes a political manifestation with, I think, potentially really horrific consequences for the nation.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking with essayist Joseph Bottom. His new book is An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. Now, Joseph Bottom, you're a Catholic writer. What has been the role of the Catholic Church in creating any sort of political consensus?
Yeah, you know, Catholicism was never America. It was never a good fit. This is a Protestant country. And it, the more you read of American history, the more you understand that to call America a religious country was really to mean that it was a Christian country, and to call it a Christian country was really a nice way of saying that it was a Protestant country. Our history is just dominated by this cultural Mississippi of Protestantism that flowed through the nation. And, you know, Catholics were always on the outside of that. But something very interesting happened once the mainline Protestant consensus began to collapse in the 1970s, which is the two largest groups of Christians who were always on the outside of that consensus, the Catholics on one side and the evangelicals on the other, got kind of sucked into the vacuum to try and fill that empty space in American public life. And this is one of the reasons that from the 1970s through the 2010s, you saw so much talk where you'd never before, not at the same level, about Catholics and evangelicals in American society. It was an extraordinary thing and yet perfectly predictable if you think about the collapse of the center, which was the mainline Protestant churches. Catholics tried to provide, some of them explicitly, some of them unknowingly, to provide a moral vocabulary, a public vocabulary, with which to replace the lost vocabulary of the mainline Protestant churches. And it had some successes. I mean, even evangelicals now speak in the language of Catholic social thought about natural law, about just war theory, about dignity as a person. That all comes out of this Catholic intellectual project to frame a vocabulary that was acceptable in a secular realm but was somehow religiously based. Ultimately, it lost. That project of Catholics and evangelicals together lost the political battle. The post-Protestants, whom I call the poster children in the book, won. And President Obama's election in 2008 demonstrated it. The statistics are very clear. Catholics vote just like everybody else. The evangelicals are a political force and a social force in decline. The numbers are pretty clear on this. So, you know, that project failed, but it was a perfectly predictable project. And all that agitation about Catholics and Catholicism and what they were doing in America on the editorial pages of the New York Times was entirely predictable, given the collapse of the mainline Protestant churches and the kind of sucking into the vacuum of Catholics.
How do you see Pope Francis having any impact on political discussion and debate in the U.S.? It seems like some of the things that he's been saying have captured the imagination of some of the secular liberals.
Well, they have, but then, you know, he also says things that are very off-putting to them. And the same with the right. I'm actually a big fan of Francis, but one of the things I think he's doing is trying to find a way out of every moral question being a political question. And he's speaking in this moral language And sometimes, you know, that will confirm people who aren't Catholics, and sometimes it won't. But if you look at the subtext of every time he makes some gesture that appears in a political world to confirm one side or another, he's actually phrasing it in non-political terms. He wants to break out of this trap that's captured Western Europe and captured the United States of somehow every moral issue and every bit of moral vocabulary being sucked up into politics.
How successful will he be with that?
I don't know. We're pretty locked in right now. The book, An Anxious Age, is as neutral as I can be. It's just a sociological examination of the nation right at this moment. And I don't have a plan in the book for how to change things. And I don't because, A, because I'm not sure what the answer would be, B, because sociological examinations are kind of supposed to be neutral, not give battle plans. But C, also, excuse me, because it seems to me that we're in a situation where this kind of spiritualizing of politics, this turning of politics into a spiritual battlefield, is locked in place pretty hard on both the left and the right. Everybody is seeing politics as, not everybody, but a huge number of people are seeing politics as this place where spiritual issues are thrashed out. And I don't see any break in that coming with any speed.
You don't see this as perhaps a generational point of view, that maybe a new generation will have a different perspective on this?
Well, things get locked in this way. For instance, the post-Protestant class has pretty much monopolized the meritocracy, the credentialing system of secondary education. They run the colleges and universities. And that will lock it in for another generation or two. Now, the actual post-Protestants, whom I describe in the book, are not having children. So there's a demographic problem that may bring their influence to an end. But there are structural ways in which they've kind of captured, you know, locations like the colleges and universities, that ensures that their view of things will go on.
Now, that view isn't necessarily a moral relative one, is it? These people believe in good and evil.
This, I think, is the key part of the book that's addressed, the thesis of the book, that's really addressed to conservatives who want to run around saying, you know, the elite class of America is somehow relativistic and atheistical and unspiritual, and they live really thin lies because they don't have any of that metaphysical richness that comes with believing in angels and demons and God and all the rest of the panoply of the great chain of being above us. And I argue in the book that, in fact, that argument has no purchase on contemporary liberal elites because it's not true. They live in a very spiritually thick world with demons and angels. They just don't call them demons and angels. They live in this world in which this dark cloud of something like racism hangs over the whole of the past of humanity and over social classes other than their own today. And that's a metaphysical, supernatural concept straight out of Rauschenbusch and the social gospel movement. And, of course, we're not going to convince them. If you're a conservative, you're not going to convince these people to give that up. That's a rich, understandable life involving notions of good and evil and spiritual thickness. So the whole argument that somehow modern liberalism is atheistical and secular is exactly what the book is addressed to knock down.
Is the book an Anxious Age? Is this voicing your concerns of the current political situation that we find ourselves in the U.S.?
In the preface and the conclusion, I say that I find this move toward the spiritualizing of politics unhealthy. And as I say, I see it on both the left and the right. But the bulk of the book is simply an attempt to do a kind of neutral observation of it happening and where it came from. But yes, I am worried about it. I think it's very, very bad for our politics. And that means very, very bad for our governance.